It's Iron Age stuff. It's or Hungary, maybe?
Yes, that, okay. Well, that I do remember sense? That now.
Yep.
Ow! Yeah. Very menopause.
Welcome to the program, Marguerite.
What day is it?
Archaeology podcast featuring your hosts Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick and I'm in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who is in Keswick Ridge.
I am, yeah. I'm in New Brunswick, folks. I'm in Studio 191, which is different than my usual venue. And Gabe and I...
Less baffling.
It is baffling. And Gabe and I have actually...
I meant you have less baffling.
I have less baffling.
Like you have fewer blankets around.
Okay, yeah. I have cork flooring, though, so I think the audio should be very crisp.
Oh, that's nice. That's excellent. And what brings you back to New Brunswick, Ken?
A little research excursion. As you're aware, Gabe and I are working on a project together with a colleague of ours, Trevor Dow, and some community members with Wolastoqiyik Nation in New Brunswick at the UNB Archives. And I'm going to be doing some field work next week as well. We've even had the opportunity, Gabe, to record podcast content in the same room.
We have, and we've actually even the same room, the same car, and while standing on the same beach. We've done that all in this trip.
All in this trip so far, and this is just a growing bit of content for that for the upcoming episode.
That's right. So we don't know what episode that will be in, listener, because we haven't actually listened to that content yet to make sure that it turned out. But hopefully we'll have some exciting content in it for you from Gabe and Ken's fabulous adventure. And if we do, Ken, am I right that we'll do another little intro to make that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Although, will it go with this episode as well, or are we going to be stepping out of time a couple of times?
I think we're going to be stepping out of time. Suffice to say, though, listener, if you have an intimate knowledge of the Department of Transportation Infrastructure, we would love, you can be sent anonymously, it can be mailed anonymously, it can be, you can do that thing where you cut the letters out of a newspaper and glue it onto some poster board and mail it to us. But we would love to know why Route 11 is not twinned. So that's a little foreshadowing. But Ken, before we get too far, we should thank the sponsors of our program this evening, and that's of course the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick and the ULETH Exchange Grant. And as always, we'd like to thank Emmanuel Ackle, who fixes many of the problems that sneak in, especially when we're traveling.
Yeah, and we'd also like to do a shout out to, since this will probably be either the first or early on in season three, a shout out to the musicians who have put together our tracks, which include Shane Dahl and Justin Henke.
Justin Henke, yes. And we thank them very much. And so we are looking forward to season three. And in the interest, though, of we understand that there may be quite a large mailbag today because we've been away from the podcast for a little bit. And in the interest of time, there is not going to be, that's right, listen, there's not going to be a prize read tonight to rename this podcast. But, and some of this is also actually, listener, just because with Ken in the province, we want to avoid... It's a funny thing about this province, listener. Ken actually knows everybody in this province. And so it can be uncomfortable if we were to dish out a major award while Ken is in the province, because there's all sorts of people who will have just encountered him and been extra inspired by just seeing him. You know, local boy, gone and made good. He's in Lethbridge. You know, that's right. He was in Lethbridge last week. He was on the local CBC this evening.
Yes,
you know,
We both were. Local celebrities now.
We were, Ken, but I don't think I could ever achieve the local celebrity status that you could. I'm an immigrant, after all. So Ken, But listener, do think about renaming this podcast for when the great prizes start rolling sometime in this season. And so, Ken, though, the listener is going to want to remember that we have an email address. And what is that email address?
That email address is newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And what's in that mailbag, Ken?
Well, so we actually have a mailbag to go through today. And so I'm going to scroll all the way through all of our Podcorn emails.
So Ken, have these emails been organized temporally or autobiographically?
Temporally. I think that's the easiest way. So we're actually going to be going all the way back to July 10th, which would have been probably when our last episode aired. Would that be fair?
Yes.
I think we're about two fortnights off the last episode.
I think that's right. I think I was poolside at that time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you were poolside for the last two episodes of season two, but you were really poolside then.
Yeah, I think I was literally poolside.
So we get an email here from Josh, and it says a couple of names. Oh, hey, Kenny and Gabriel, a couple of name suggestions, and we have a bulleted list here.
Oh my goodness. Is this a Josh that we know?
This is the Josh that we know. Yes. The Josh that was in my wedding. Tall gentleman, cousin of mine, excellent. Dear friend. Yeah.
Great.
So we have Chip and Flake, : tales from a couple of tools. Under earthen searching. No.
Oh, that one's, I like that.
Yeah. With the, it's the apostrophe N and searching with S-E-A-R-C-H apostrophe N. So we're leaning into the New Brunswick vibe.
Yeah, I tell you what, Ken, it's a good thing we declared that there would not be a winner this week, or else we might be in serious trouble.
Exactly.
Not some of these names. Yeah. These are great.
Although I've already promised Josh some stickers when I saw him on the boat last night. So that
good.
Good. Know where you at to get where you at. Past peeping Tommies. I don't think that's going to get us any more listeners that we want.
No, I think maybe not. Wrong crowd.
I think there might be some innuendos in these ones. Dusty hands of time.
This is going to get us in. This is how we end up being the number one podcast at the men's prison at Attica.
Yeah, exactly. Past yard by yard agains, play on backyard agains. A series of layers. That's a good one. He's getting into the stratigraphy there. Dig-chat-repeat. That's also a good one.
Okay.
Notes of the Underground.
That's a highbrow reference.
It is.
There.
He's given us some radio names here. KB and Jen, or Gen, I guess. KB and Gen. Words of the Pen. I'm not sure why we had to.
What time in the morning did this come in, Ken? This email.
8:43 on July 10th. So this was this was. I think he got into the office and he fired this off immediately.
Yes.
And
I won't ask who this was billed to.
Where have we been? And under land and sea spelled S E E. Sorry, but I have to get back to work now. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Josh.
We appreciate that, especially the first couple.
Yeah, that's excellent. Okay, so moving ahead. So Tamara sent us an email. Hi, Ken and Gabe. I'm an avid listener of your podcast, and I was wondering if you would do a podcast on the dig that is happening at Fort Ann National Historic Site. And Tamara says, P.S., if you need anyone to do any, quote, grunt work as a volunteer for any dig, I would love to. I'm in Fredericton. Well, thank you, Tamara.
Thanks, Tamara.
So we actually have some contacts in the Parks Canada world, and maybe we can reach out to those folks and see what's up at Fort Ann. I know a couple of archaeologists that have worked there in the past, and we've got some contacts, and that is certainly a fascinating site. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Fort Ann is in the lovely town of Annapolis Royal, and is one of these pretty spectacular 17th century French forts, and one that has had fairly substantial reconstruction done, but there's ongoing excavations there all the time. I actually took my family there last year. Lots of fun to puddle around in that area.
Yeah, I've actually never been, but I think we should absolutely reach out to those folks. And thank you very much, Tamara.
Yeah, thank you for the inside tip. Okay, David says, and this is our friend David that shared a lab with us. He was a former graduate student at UNB, and I believe he's at CUNY now doing his master's or PhD.
PhD candidate at
CUNY. So that's the, what is the acronym? University of New York. The state universities really did a number with those ones, eh?
Oh man, it's I always dread if there's a publication that was published by the State University of New York.
Yeah.
Because the names have always changed, and so you have to like look up, you know, as you're filling out the bibliography, you know, is it the University of Albany? Is it the State University of Albany, New York?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. All right, this one says NBAP in the bath, .. and the SAA archaeological record. Dear Ken and Gabe, I was listening to a recent episode of NBAP this evening while relaxing and taking a break over a glass of Guinness. After getting out of the tub, yep, you were my bathing entertainment, I went for a short walk and checked the mail. To my surprise, the most recent issue of the SAA archaeological record was in my mailbox. I set it aside for after-dinner reading. While enjoying some decaf coffee with a liberal, quote, splash of oat milk, I read through your piece. Partway through, I thought incorporating this podcast or similar into undergraduate curricula would be a fantastic way to engage students. I leaned over, grabbed my pen off the side table, and scribbled on the margins, quote, podcat, I think that says podcast, as teaching tool and future. In the next paragraph, you made the same suggestion. Earlier, while I had ripped the plastic sleeve off the magazine and started to flip through it, I had only planned to read your piece, but while closing the magazine after reading yours, I noticed the headlines of the pieces that followed. The entire issue is dedicated to pedagogic topics, and experience and engaged learning are common themes throughout the articles. Intrigued, I read them all, after which I sat down to write this email. Something made clear in all the pieces was a need for experiential and engaged learning. They clearly conveyed that archaeology, specifically in the classroom, has been uprooted. One of my biggest sorrows is that as a discipline that sprouted from the earth and an interest in the buried bounties of the archaeological record, we've become a pothos in a glass of water on the windowsill beside the lab computer. We've been uprooted. More and more, our time and that of our colleagues is spent in the lab using new tech to study the stuff people used and the places they lived their lives. Gabe and Ken, and this is in italics, what are your thoughts on technology, both established and emergent, i.e. digital photography, GIS, 3D models, etc., in relation to archaeological research and pedagogy? Are such technologies sufficient proxies for field schools and experiences of archaeological things and places? Do they create more issues than they solve? Conducting excavations in the course of research or schooling is not always possible or nor appropriate for many reasons which I won't go into here, in addition to the experiential and engaged approaches discussed in the recent issue of the SAA Archaeological Record. What are your thoughts about the intentional and focused use of experience and engagement with archaeological landscapes as an alternative avenue of fieldwork? Can visiting and experiencing archaeological places and landscapes provide us with data to use in our interpretation of the past? Can our experiences provide a window into the experiences of people 100, 1,000, or 5,000 years ago? Are these analogies only possible for cultural descendants? Can any contemporary human possibly understand or relate to the experiences of people thousands of years in the past? Best regards, David. P.S. I could not for the life of me find your email listed in the podcast socials. Let's hope I can spell archaeology! And you did, David. Congratulations.
Well, and clearly, David, you can tell that we're very good at technology here because we failed to put our email address on any of our socials or on our website. So we've definitely nailed that.
That might be something we update. I think the short answer for David is that I think you've given us essentially an entire episode of to gnaw on. But I think you probably have some initial thoughts, Gabe.
I do, yeah. And so I'm reminded of some of the interesting work that I know David is doing in this area involving interesting imaging. I think one of the things I worry about, Ken, and I wonder how you feel about this, and we've actually talked a bit about this today. We have a text message thread that exists among a large group of Northeast archaeologists, which we sort of use to share things. And so in that sense, I think of technology as being this kind of great community helping, research supporting activity, right? Like that because we can just text these pictures to one another, it's hard for me to be too grumpy about it. But I also think that there are ways in which That technology is just supporting a kind of community that we made in a much more natural, kind of traditional way, right? At conferences, friendships, these kinds of things, working together in the field. I think that actually can be extrapolated into other things too, right? Whereas when we think about GIS, right, or we think about forms of imaging or all the things you can access online, or even that you can basically visit sites online now and sort of tour through them virtually, that I'm in favor of that. I think it's great. I think I would just worry if it replaced the actual human interactions and insights that can be gleaned in dealing with the world. And I also just sort of think that the world is a beautiful and interesting place. And I think it's, the archaeological record is the same thing. It ought to be interacted with in person some too.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't add a whole lot to that other than to say that I don't think you're ever going to be able to swap a field experience. And I think for most archaeologists, a field school or a dig that you're out on, probably some of your first field experiences are going to be formative experiences. Many memories are made at field schools. Hopefully they're good ones and things that you carry with you throughout your career. And there really is something to be said, like you said, about the beauty of being out there in nature. It is a lot of fun to go out and do, see beautiful places. I think both of us have had a ton of opportunities to go see really unique places in the world and kind of in our local communities and in capacities that I don't think we would have been able to without doing archaeology, including, as we talked about in length last week, nearly 30 kilometers of the right-of-way to the west of the current Route 11.
That's right. more on when the DTI listener says it. But Ken, I think we should flag that as another. That probably deserves a whole episode treatment.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something really important there, David. And that is how we integrate technology into pedagogy, into teaching about archaeology. But also, I think we need to be aware that technology doesn't replace in the field archaeology, even if there are sort of critical issues that relate to, you know, collections management and things like that. I don't think we're going to see a wholesale replacement. And I think it is really difficult to understand archaeology without getting out and doing some outdoors, I think would probably be.
I think so. Yeah. But let's flag this for another episode. And we should also flag that we should have David on to talk about the work that he's doing for his dissertation.
I think that is an excellent idea.
So, and don't worry, David, the important thing is that you remember to get a USB mic that doesn't need to be plugged in, and you can tune in from the back. That won't be a problem.
Exactly,
we just don't want anyone
exactly
getting zapped.
Yeah, we don't need any electrocutions.
Yeah. That is the second archaeologist I've heard about who likes to work in the bath, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a huge bather.
I'm not either.
If I'm feeling crummy, I might do that. But I could see listening to podcasts in the bath. I'm not sure if I'd listen to our podcast in the bath.
Maybe a hot spring.
Maybe a hot spring. There you go. We do have a couple of other emails in here, but we are cutting it a little tight for time in terms of going through the mailbag. I think we have time for one more, and this one says podcast name, and this is from Sean, who says he's a brand new listener to our podcast. So I think I'd like to highlight this one, and we've got a few that we can read on the next episode as well. So stay tuned, if you have sent in mail, we have seen it. It will be read very soon. So,
and Sean, we'll try to get some stickers in the mail if you've given us an address.
Yes, and I suspect I owe a lot of people stickers. That is on my list of things to do when I get back to Lethbridge.
Yeah. Also, sorry, Ken, I'm aware that we're short on time, but the listeners should also know we've had a problem in our sticker supply chain.
Yes.
And in a source of great frustration, if you know somebody who is a great sticker printer,
yep.
Ken and I are changing companies,
yes,
of our sticker dealers.
We would love to support either a local person doing it or a Canadian company, I think would be fantastic. But if you just know of somebody who has good ethics and maybe not a firm political stance in their company, then We don't need politics. Well,
it depends
stickers.
A little on the firm political stance, but yeah. the one in our previous sticker dealer has proven objectionable to us.
Yeah, it could. It's a matter of taste. So Sean says, as a brand new listener,
and the preservation of the West.
And the preservation of democracy in the world. As a brand new listener to your podcast, I would like to make a case for not renaming it. Okay. Well, looking podcast.
Sean's a little contrary.
Yeah. Well, looking through podcast options and science categories, I was a bit overwhelmed by the vast expanse of generic tongue-in-cheek names when what did I stumble upon but an archaeology podcast based in New Brunswick. I was really hoping he would say New Brunswick, New Jersey. Now, given the fact that I lived in Minnesota, which is not anywhere close to New Brunswick, and I'm not an archaeologist, you might wonder what would attract me to such a thing. 20 years ago, when I was just starting my career in software development, I ended up living in the beautiful city of Fredericton for about 4 months while implementing software for NB Power. My time there was arduous, but also rewarding and formative for me, and I made a lot of good friends. I've been back to Fredericton a number of times since then for both business and pleasure, and it remains important to me. If not for the name of the podcast, I would probably still be looking for quality listening material. Thanks, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Sean.
Yeah, thanks, Sean, and welcome to the program. It's great to hear from you. Make sure you send us an address so we can send you some stickers.
Yeah, okay. And Gabe, I've just seen a new icon appear for our guest. We're joined by Margarita de Guzman, who is the CEO and Managing Director of Circle CRM Group, operating out of Calgary, Alberta. This is a company that she grew from her apartment to span several provinces and territories with over 30 employees now. She's also a permit holder herself in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Yukon, and Northwest Territories. Margarita has over 20 years of experience in archaeology and holds degrees in both archaeology and economics, including a BA in economics from UBC, a BA in archaeology from SFU, so Simon Fraser, and a master's in archaeology following Durham. And following which, she spent 5 years working in Europe at Iron Age, Roman, and Urartu sites, and later founded and co-directed the SVG Public Archaeology Program on the island of St. Vincent. Margarita has published in the Journal of Field Archaeology, Vegetation History, and Archaeobotany, and is a founding director of the Fairfield Foundation, a collaborative network to connect, champion, and celebrate female archaeologists through training opportunities, network events, and mentorship. We have reached Margarita during a busy field season, and she has been kind enough to give us some time to talk about her work and this fantastic initiative. Welcome to the show, Margarita.
Thank you. Nice to be here. The only thing is, I don't remember this publication in some vegetation book. I don't think that's me.
Oh, okay. Well, you are attributed, I confirmed it is you because it's
okay.
I have a it's
memory
something
of it
to
now.
Do with it's Iron Age stuff. It's or Hungary maybe.
Yes. Is that, okay. What that I makes do remember sense? That now.
Yep.
Ow. Yeah.
Welcome to the program, Margarita.
What is it?
Yeah, listener, you think Margarita threw away that vegetation history paper? Just wait till someone says, and she appeared on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. She's like, oh, I don't remember that.
I'm like, that was an award-winning podcast. I was really happy to be part of it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations, by the
but
way,
we do really
on that award.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we really appreciate you coming on, in part because we've both been really interested in chatting with you about the Fairfield Foundation, which and we sort of thought you could just tell us to start a little bit about it and how it got started and what issues it's working to address.
For sure. Thank you for your interest in the Fairfields. You know, it was born a few years ago. The idea sparked like before COVID. And the busier I am in the field, the harder it is to devote time to it. So whenever people talk to me about it, I'm like, oh, wow, this is so great that we still have a presence, in the world out there. So, as you know, the CAAs came to Edmonton
ended up being 2 years because of COVID, eh?
Yeah, like it was supposed to happen during the COVID year. So I was joined the planning committee in 2019, I guess. And then it didn't happen during COVID and it happened the year after. So I joined the planning committee for the Edmonton CAAs and the chair was Keisha Supernat. And during the online CAAs that were the year after, somehow I took it upon myself to create an event for Women in Archaeology. And it was a, it wasn't recorded, it was a panel. And I pulled together some people, the chair of the CA at the time, oh my gosh, Lisa?
Lisa Hodgetts?
Yes, Lisa Hodgetts. She connected me with Lisa Rankin and Amelia Fay, who was a curator in Manitoba. And then I have some connections with Cleanza, another consulting company out west, so Jenny Lewis. And I was also connected with Holly Martel, who owns Timmins Martel in Ontario. And we did a little panel. I hope I didn't forget anybody. But I hosted the panel, and those women just brought it. Like, their answers to the questions were just so amazing and so inspiring. And it sparked a seed. We wanted to do more with, you know, that energy that they brought, not just to them, to each other and to themselves, to ourselves, but the people that were there also really enjoyed that panel. So we were on, Cleanza has a podcast called, oh, my memory is so horrible.
We could follow up with you and throw it in the show notes too afterwards, if that's helpful.
They have something. It's about doing archaeology for good. So we did another panel with these same women. And so, you know, as a woman in archaeology and as a business owner, I've seen a lot of women, you know, walk through our doors and, you know, back in the day when you used to be able to ask, like, oh, what wage do you expect and things like that. I've just really noticed a pattern in women where we kind of ask for less and have lower confidence, and I see it more prevalent in the younger women. So it was just something that I was familiar with and was passionate about. So I have a marketing and communication strategy team, Gentle Lion Communications, and they really helped me bring this to life. Like, we had a 4-hour naming session. We have a strategy. We have a brand identity. We have core values. And they really help bring it to life so that we can support women in archaeology. And, you know, at first it was called the Female Archaeology Foundation. We didn't like the acronym. So that's why we had the naming session. And it was called the Fairfield because we could then expand outside of women and outside of archaeology because, you know, we're not the only group that feels marginalized at some times or just really need support. So yeah, they really help bring it to life. And it's really difficult because it's definitely volunteer based. And so everybody who's part of it apologizes that they're not doing more. But I feel like, you know, if we can positively impact one person, then we're already winning.
Yeah, I mean, that's a challenge with all these organizations, right? It's all volunteer driven and, you know, everybody has commitments, but it's sort of that teamwork. Like, you guys have a sort of pretty impressive looking board of directors that I'm sure, you know, everybody doing a little bit, it's pretty clear that it's come together really, really cleanly. So,
yeah, and the panel you mentioned is really kind of a who's who's of Canadian archaeology.
Yeah,
too,
yeah,
which
very
is
much
very impressive,
so.
Impressive, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and sorry, Keisha was part of that panel as well. And then the Kamloops discovery was made, and she was really obviously just too busy to be part of the Fairfield Foundation, but she's very supportive of it. But yeah, it's a really inspiring group of women.
That's great. And so we should just say at the front for the listener who might want to, like, sort of follow along online, it's Fairfield Foundation, and Fairfield is two words. And could you tell us your website?
I should actually look up. It's thefairfieldfoundation.com.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you very much. I just think it's possible the listener might want to dip in and out of that while we have our conversation.
There is thefairfieldfoundation.org, which we discovered later. And it's another group in the States that is also tied to archaeology, but just has a very slightly different strategy, so not to be confused.
It looks like the podcast name of Cleanza is Dig This.
Yes,
podcast.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. We will throw that in the show notes, listener.
Some of the initiatives that the Fairfield Foundation is undertaking are sort of centered around sort of empowering women within not just archaeology, sort of in the field more broadly. But one of the things I saw on the website is that you guys have a mentorship program, and you had mentioned that one of the the panelists are all sort of established academics and owner operators and CRM firms. So is the mentorship to sort of work with up-and-coming professionals or students or really any women or up-and-coming archaeologists that are looking to make those sort of network connections?
Yeah, so we surveyed our founding directors, and it was pretty much unanimous that that's the impact they wanted to make was mentorship. And you don't have to have like 20 years in the business or whatever field of archaeology you're in. We feel that you can provide mentorship at any stage in your career. So we would match you up. Like if someone is looking for early stage mentorship, someone who's been doing this for 5 years can certainly provide that mentorship and could probably more closely relate to whatever experiences they're having, as opposed to someone who's been doing it for 20 years. You know, some of us are a little bit more jaded and have different viewpoints nowadays. So it's from women across the board. And we also invite people to be both mentees and mentors, because certainly like when people started signing up, like Chelsea is one of our founding directors, Chelsea Kohlberg-Posch from New Brunswick. You guys know her, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love her. She was a guest on one of our panels, and she hosted one of our panels, and then she became a mentor. And I was like, can I be your mentee? And, you know, the answer is yes, of course. But there are other people that obviously would need her expertise more. So, yeah, it's for people across the board, for sure. And we have people from CRM and academia. And museums. So as part of the intake form, you provide like how much experience you have and what your expertise is in and really what you're looking for. And also like, you know, what time of day can you meet? How often do you want to meet? So we're trying to ensure that there's a successful relationship there.
That's great. And are the meetings typically sort of over Zoom, or are they, is it regionally matched?
We try to have it regionally matched, but they are mostly over Zoom. I know that Amelia, who is in Manitoba, she had met her mentee in person, I believe, a few times, and that was a really great pairing. Amelia hosted a session at the last CAAs, and her mentee did a presentation at it, and it was really nice to see. Yeah.
That's great. And we're loving to hear all the East Coast representation on here, too. Amelia, I don't know actually if she's from out East, but went to school out East.
Yeah, so I wanted to make sure there was representation across the country. Yeah. And we have a couple of women in Quebec. And so obviously sometimes there's mentorship in French, and a lot of us don't speak any French, at least out here. So, it's really nice that we actually have pairings across the country.
That's terrific. Could you tell us a little bit about the sort of other events that the Fairfield has conducted? So you've had an annual presence at the CAAs, but we're kind of curious about the other, even in addition to mentorship, things that you all do.
Yeah, so we did a soft launch in Edmonton when we finally had the conference in person. And so the goal was to have an annual in-person event at the CAAs and to have the mentorship program and to have quarterly online panels. Those kind of fell to the wayside. In the beginning, we had a panel on we brought someone who had 1 year experience, 10 years experience, and 20 years experience, and they shared their stories. And then we had a parenthood panel. And then we had all these ideas, but everyone just got so busy that they really just fell on the wayside. But we want to do more online panels. But the annual CAA event is kind of easy for us, because I like to go to the CAAs every year, and there isn't much involved in creating that event. And I find that as time goes on, the people that organize the CAAs are aware of what we do, and they actually set aside an event for women in archaeology. So instead of someone else hosting it and organizing it, then it can kind of always be us, and we're cool with that. And then there's
events. Is that the women's luncheon that they've been hosting the last couple of years?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. We did a luncheon in Nova Scotia, and I actually didn't like the luncheon because people rush in afterwards from coming to a session, then they have to leave early to go to a session. So we actually don't have a lot of time, but then it's okay, because really the mandate was meet a couple of people and network, right? And last year in Saskatoon, we did more of a happy hour event, so that just gives us more time, and I enjoy those events a little bit more. Yeah, and it was so awesome because Alice Kehoe showed up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, amazing. And she came up and talked to me, and she had her name tag on. I was just like, oh, my God, it's Alice Kehoe. And it was amazing. It was just really nice. Everyone was like, oh, my God, it's Alice Kehoe. And she started telling us all these stories about her early days as an archaeologist. And it was just so cool. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. That's great. And so you've done the 1, 10 and 20-year careers and further, it sounds like, essentially. It's not just on the panels, but even at the bar, it extends into the past of Canadian archaeology.
I also hosted a session at last year, not Saskatoon, but in Nova Scotia. I think my memory is horrible. But we hosted a session and invited, you know, a lot of young women are really nervous to do a presentation, especially students. So we just wanted to have a venue for people who haven't done presentations before to, you know, present on their thesis or whatever. That came out really well as well.
Yeah, that's
great.
Yeah. Critical skills like that. It's kind of getting, like the students, getting them up to that comfort level with conference presentation can be a little bit intimidating. Mm-hmm. So it'd be nice to be able to kind of ease into that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate a little bit too on the some take home points from the Parenthood panel?
Oh man, Parenthood is.
I'm sorry, I'm totally putting you on the spot. This was not on the list, listener. I just was interested in it because I know a lot of our listeners are parents.
Sure. Yeah, who are in archaeology. It is hard to balance. That's
For sure, for women and men, like across the board, right? We internally we have some men with young children and. We want to support their wives also who also have their full-time jobs, even though it's not in archaeology. But that was a really eye-opening one. I myself am not a parent, and I always wonder how people do it. And it's interesting because, you know, it depends really on the support network you have locally. And there's a really pretty infamous story about the Clianza, Amanda and Jenny, how they... As owners, they are able to make more decisions. And, you know, one of them took a trailer out with them to the field and brought their children and a caregiver to take care of their children so they should go in the field. And when I worked in Europe, I was working with women who like carried their babies on their backs while they were traveling, and there was a baby in a wheelbarrow, you know, just lie down there for a while, you know. I think the biggest takeaway from that is that we really just have to ask for what we can have. Like, what are some solutions that we can offer? We don't have to accept the state of the world as it is. And if you don't have those options where you work, you can look somewhere else for somewhere else to work. You know, a lot of people don't think they have those options to change their place of work, but you know, especially in this day and age, there are so many options that you don't have to accept the way it is. You know, we have to think of more creative solutions so that people can stay in this field and continue to do this job while caring for a young family. It definitely is difficult and is definitely a challenge, but the biggest thing is really just to ask and see what you can get, you know?
Yeah, and that kind of ties in with that mentorship that you talked about, with asserting, sort of being more assertive and being willing to or having the confidence to approach and sort of tell your employer, or in the setting that you're in, to kind of assert yourself a little bit more and try to get a little bit more of what you would like out of your own work, basically. And that's something that you got. It sounded like that's part of what you guys try to work into the mentorship program.
Mm-hmm. I try to instill that in like everyone that works here. I remember a long time ago, I taught English in Japan and only for 9 months. And my parents were actually in the Philippines at the time. And I was like, I need a haircut and I need to get a new visa stamp. So I went over to the Philippines and I was like, can you take me to get a haircut? So my mom was like, I'll take you to the best hairdresser in town. And so I went there and it was like the worst haircut I ever had. I looked like a 70-year-old. I don't know if you guys know who Imelda Marcos is, but I felt like I was Imelda Marcos, and it was the worst hair ever. And I got back in the car.
We'll put Imelda Marcos in the show notes.
And I got back in the car, and my mom was like, why are you crying? I'm like, because I hate my hair. And she's like, well, why didn't you say anything? And she's like, never do that. Always speak up. And I just remember that. It's such a powerful memory because my hair was so bad. And that's the smallest thing, you know, to say, like, I hate my hair. And now we're dealing with bigger challenges. Like, I need to be with my baby, you know, that's so huge. So I think it starts from the smallest things.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And I really like that anecdote. And it also, I think, really speaks to I imagine to, I'm not a parent either, but that for folks in field disciplines generally, that this is probably really important. And I mean, that sort of some of the people you've listed here who are like running major companies, it seems like it's likely that the Fairfield Foundation might sort of inspire a broader cultural change in, you know, the kinds of companies that do environmental impact stuff broadly, even beyond archaeology.
I visited a company once in Edmonton. I don't think that company exists anymore, and I cannot remember the name for the life of me, but it was also owned by two women, and they opened a daycare in their office. And as they were showing me around, the owner was like, we didn't create this daycare for profit. We created it to keep women in our industry. And it was amazing. Like, it was a full legit daycare. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
That's a pretty good perk too. Yeah. But, it's also very difficult to find daycare. So that's like, not just that there is one there, it's that there's a space available for daycare.
Yeah.
As anybody who's trying to find their children daycare is we're all, you're always in a pickle there.
We should try to get a daycare sponsor for the podcast.
Yeah. We'll give away the whoever renames the podcast gets a daycare space that we've secured for them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you had, you talked about one particular example of a mentor-mentee relationship that was really positive and that kind of transcended into, you know, a conference attendance and that sort of thing. Can you think of any other, do you have any other examples of some of the successes that came out of that program, or maybe like an example of like, maybe just as one of the successes that you guys, like you're particularly proud of that Fairfield has facilitated a relationship or change or kind of a career moment for someone?
Yeah, actually, someone who used to work for me, they were going through grad school, trying to finish their master's thesis, and they had some challenges. And I couldn't be their mentor, obviously, because I was their boss. So I actually called, I called another owner, and asked her to be a mentor, and I paired them up, and it was apparently really instrumental to her finishing her thesis. Like, she edited it like crazy and really provided some excellent mentorship to help her finish her thesis and really contributed to her successfully completing her master's degree. I thought that was a really great story because that's really going above and beyond, right? Like, the mentorship can be just a 1-hour conversation. What are your wins? What are your challenges? And then what are your next steps? And you kind of go from there. But like for that person to take that thesis and read the whole thing with a thorough eye is really above and beyond. And I think that was really amazing.
That's incredible. I mean, I get paid to read students' theses that way.
But it's also sometimes you need that outside voice, like, you know, the master's project and PhD projects can be a very lonely time sometimes. And sometimes you need somebody who's completely unaffiliated with it to have a outside glance and maybe that outside voice.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic.
And extra insight too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Margaret, you run a growing and busy CRM company, which is very exciting. And so we wondered what you saw as some of the biggest hurdles just in CRM today, right? What are some of the big challenges?
Oh, man, I think that the CRM industry is in crisis right now, at least in Western Canada. You know, in Alberta, you need a master's degree. In BC, it's very experience-based. And there's a huge shortage of field directors in BC and a shortage of senior level permit holders, archaeologists and permit holders in Alberta and probably in Western Canada. And I could probably say Canada, but I can't speak to the industry out east. I'm just so unfamiliar with it. But here, like, you know, looking for a senior archaeologist has been the challenge of the last, like, decade, right? And our challenge right now is how do we attract and retain senior staff when, you know, I think I'm finding that, you know, after a few years, people are looking for career progression. And so part of that career progression is often getting out of the field, for example. So less field work, more office work. But there aren't enough people coming out of grad school and not a lot enough people coming out of undergraduate school with a desire to enter CRM. And then if they enter CRM, there actually isn't that much training in universities to prepare them for CRM because there's no, like, there's very little hands-on training about, like, what it's like to do CRM. They come out and they're like, I've done field school. I'm like, cool. It's going to be nothing like that.
It's a little bit different.
Yeah. So, you know, part of, like, when we go to career fairs and stuff, we try to be really transparent about what it might be like. Because we've had people that, you know, go out and do a shift and they come back and they're like, well, I was really homesick and can I just do this part time? And like, no, that's not going to work. So there's quite a few challenges, but the biggest challenge is there's just a growing lack of archaeologists, not just that there aren't enough archaeologists in CRM or that there aren't enough archaeologists staying in CRM so that we have senior level, you know, really great archaeologists, but also, like, there's actually a growing demand for our services. The requirements are increasing, especially in BC. There's just so much work. And then in BC, in unceded territory, we have to consider having the Indigenous people come out with us and train them to be archaeologists. And they don't have the capacity to do it either. There's such a capacity issue and then a training issue. I think I'm totally rambling now, but basically there's a crisis in that there are not enough archaeologists.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of from all angles. Right. And
If you sort of, cause I'm just curious from someone in your position, if you had thoughts about how to fix that problem, do you have sort of thoughts about it? Is it something universities could do? Do we need to, train aliens to
I think one thing you could start with is at these trade fairs you get, you know, those like those cash wind tunnels where the money comes up from the floor. Do that, but make sure you put a ton of mosquitoes in there, and if they can survive with all the mosquitoes and grab all the money, then they'll know they're ready for CRM. So
it's hard to believe no one's contacted Ken for mentorship. I don't know
that's such a great idea. Actually, throw in a wasp every now and again.
Yeah, exactly. And crank up the temperature. Like, you gotta have the humidity to about 80% and have it at least 32 degrees.
Yeah, totally. You know, I think part of it is CRM does need to have more of a presence at universities, but, you know, CRM isn't the only track for archaeology. In Western Canada, you know, CRM does employ most of the archaeologists and most of the archaeology sites are recorded by CRM professionals. So it is important that we have a stronger presence in the universities. I don't know what that looks like. I'm not an academic, but I would love to, it's always been on my list to just go to universities, you know, once a semester and maybe do a guest lecture or even just do a presentation on here's what CRM looks like. Here's what your future can look like. Look at how much fun these people are having, you know, just to share with them what the experience could be, because we've actually hired a few people here who, like, one person, her dad sent her our job posting. She's like, I didn't even know this was a career. I'm like, what? How did you not know? So there's if we can increase the awareness, number one, we could probably attract more archaeologists at the undergraduate stage. And then the graduate stage. I'm not sure, right? Like, there's archaeology departments closing all over the place. That's a huge challenge. But I hear there's this new CRM master starting up.
I was just going to say, we might have to have you come down the road sometime in the next couple months, that maybe for a guest appearance in a couple classes at Lethbridge.
I would love to.
Yeah. Well, it would be fantastic. And I think it, I mean, I can talk about CRM from my own experience, but because I worked in BC for one field season, but I was young enough then that I wasn't really in a field directorship position. And I haven't worked in commercial CRM for several years now. And so I think it's really important for, even when we're teaching CRM, like I teach a CRM course at University of Lethbridge for undergrads and for graduate students, but having somebody who is in industry now be able to explain the challenges today and what the job requirements are today. And in particular, because a lot of our students are looking to stay in Alberta or Western Canada in general, that perspective is really important. So yeah, we'll take this offline and figure something out. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I really like that perspective, because here at the U of C, Lindsay Amundsen-Meyer, I think, is doing a really great job. You know, she used to work in CRM, but just the fact that she is now not in CRM and is teaching these individuals, they're seeing that she left CRM, right? So that's a perspective, like in the back of their minds, they're like, well, she was in CRM and she's not anymore. Why didn't she stay? And it's for a whole variety of reasons, right? But I really like that phrase of you can only be what you can see. And so to meet with professionals that are working currently, I think is a really great idea. Like, if I'll show up with, like, you know, my farmer's tan and mosquito bites and, you know, and be like, look how happy I am.
Yeah. And I advise bringing stickers and pens. The students love swag. So that's, you know, that's always a big win.
We love swag too. We like to say, we like to think that we're the best swaggers. I just ordered a whole bunch more. I'll give you guys some when I see you next.
Excellent.
I can't wait. Yeah,
we'll do an exchange.
We're pretty avid collectors of CRM swag, actually. Awesome. It's one of our passions.
What's the coolest piece of swag that you've gotten?
I like this. Your feeling is this is a challenge now. So I like this. But we got waterproof backpacks from Eco4.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was pretty good.
It was pretty neat. And they were presented to us from a dear friend who Gabe had been badgering. Had seen these backpacks a couple of years ago and had been badgering for a while as a joke. And then they appeared one day.
Nice.
My daughter really likes the insulated water bottle that we got from Eco4 as well. So she's taken that as her own.
Nice.
Ken, we thought we might need a sponsorship from like Canadian Club or Tim Hortons or some other venerable, company that's associated with Canada, but really we're just going to start a swag arms race.
Exactly. Yeah. And we can get you guys free promo stuff. So, you know, we get the swag and you guys get the advertising. It seems like a perfect economic relationship.
Ken, you're not gonna fool Margarita. She also has a degree in economics.
Yeah, really.
So long ago.
So you've got a pretty global archaeology resume. You've done like stuff in Europe. You're all over Western Canada and the North and everything. I was really interested to read about this public archaeology program that you did in St. Vincent. Number one, kudos for finding archaeology in the Caribbean. This is something that I feel like at some point in my career, I need to have an island that I can go to do some archaeology that's in a warm spot, to do some field vacations, that kind of thing. But so can you tell us a little bit about the work, how it came about, what the work was, I guess? It sounds like a pretty neat experience.
For sure. It was awesome. I was very fortunate enough to go to St. Vincent through the company I worked at before, which was Bison, and Joe Moravitz, who was one of the owners there. He actually did his master's work down in St. Vincent. And somehow they contacted him, probably through also Richard Callahan at the U of C, who's done a lot of work out there. St. Vincent was building an international airport, and the CEO of the airport development company is from, can't remember where he's from, but he was trained at a Western university, and there's no legislation in St. Vincent for any of that stuff. But he took it upon himself to be like, you know, there needs to be an EIA. We need to follow, you know, proper protocols. So Joe was allowed to bring two people down to do some initial work. And so he brought me and my partner, Jode, who also works with me. And we went down, and the plan was to, I think the plan was for like 2 weeks, and I ended up staying for 2 months. We found 700 features. You know, think of how long it takes to dig a post hole, and like, we're like, how do we dig all these? Like, we borrowed prisoners from the local prison to come and dig, to come and help us dig. And we're like, what is that guy in jail for? You know? And we had like local volunteers come, but what ended up happening was we started to find burials as they were like, you know, scraping the dirt away to help clean it for us. We started to find burials, and the sediment was so compact. Like it was like digging through cement. We're using dental picks, so the work was so slow. So we could only accomplish, you know, very little. And yeah, so as I said, I was there for 2 months. And then Richard Callahan brought me back for, I think it was for another month, to do some research. So we were able to do a little bit more. And then we were like, what do we do? There's no funding. The airport doesn't want to pay any more money. So I was like, well, let's do a public archaeology program. I had worked in Italy before, and my old boss had charged these students like 1,500 euros or something for a week to come and dig. And he's like, everyone wants to dig. It's everyone's dream to go on an archaeology dig. I'm like, it is everyone's dream. So I like built a website. You know, this is back in 2010. I didn't know what I was doing. I made a poster and I put it up at the library, like little things like that. So I created the public archaeology program, and I had separated it from Bison because I had also left at the same time to start Circle. So our first season, we had, I think, 8 people. And in my dreams, we had like 30 people. So we really, it was very like, it was not for profit, because we gave any extra money to the local trust to help people that were like displaced from the airport construction, and to help with the National Trust itself, which oversees protection of natural resources and archaeology. So it's not for profit, but you know, we got to be in the Caribbean for a month, and then we did it again the year after, and the focus ended up being on burials. So the year after, we had quite a few archaeologists from the States, because you don't have the opportunity to work on burials. And remembering, like, these are indigenous populations, but they're not aware of their indigenous past. Like, they think that they're descendants from slave ships from the 1600s. But we know from the pottery and the work that Joe did that, you know, these burials we were finding were 1 to 2,000 years old. So we felt it was really important work. And there's probably still a lot under the runway. So, yeah, we only did 2 seasons, and then like, we just got too busy. We couldn't do any more. And the person that was at the National Trust also left. So we just didn't, the project just sadly kind of ended, but it was really exciting work.
Yeah. This sounds like sort of an incredible like case study, and you know, what happens when you don't have appropriate heritage legislation and the challenges with funding archaeology and like heritage preservation and everything. Like, this is just, yeah, I mean, I'm sure the work was incredible, but also the story itself is sort of insane. Also, and like prisoners were, I'm assuming they did not participate in the public archaeology program as well. They were more compelled to do the work the first time.
Yeah, no, they were there when Bison got paid to do the work with Joe. So yeah, when we did the public archaeology piece, it was the paying volunteers, mostly from Canada. We did have a woman from Greece, and then we had some Americans. And we had local school groups come. So the National Trust would organize some volunteers to come and help dig. But we found that, you know, they wouldn't stay all day. It wasn't that kind of volunteering, right? Because you're really lying around trying to move dirt with a dental pick because the dirt was so compact. Yeah, but it was fascinating. I could do a whole presentation on that, to be honest. We had some really amazing finds. When people ask me, like, what is the most amazing thing that you found? I do bring up some examples from there. Because we found, like, a cache of stone axes. We found, like, a jade necklace with frog-shaped beads. Like, we found some pretty cool stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Neat. And we'll, of course, put links to your publications in the show notes and some information about that. So, but feel free to send us anything else to add to the show notes to make sure the listener can follow up on any of that. We're also mindful of your time because we've interrupted you in an evening during a busy field season. So I think where Ken and I wanted to wrap up was just to ask if you had any sort of closing thoughts about Fairfield or about resources that folks should look into if they're interested in the Fairfield Foundation, or just sort of your closing thoughts about this and where it's headed.
Or if we have some unemployed field directors that are looking for a new opportunity in Alberta, where do they reach out, right?
Yeah, one time I posted on LinkedIn, like, I know you all have a job, what will it take you for you to come over this way? So we're really trying to be creative about our compensation. But, you know, one of my biggest why actually is to like bring more people along for the ride. Like our why here at Circle is that we love the past and we're making it exciting and we're trying to bring more people along for the ride. And the Fairfield is part of that because, you know, we see people leave the industry for various reasons and we feel like we can help mitigate a lot of those reasons through the Fairfield Foundation, especially because it's not specifically tied to a company, you know. People are more hesitant, I think, to be like, oh, Circle's providing a mentorship program. Let's go there. But because the Fairfield is like, you know, agnostic and it's not, you're not supporting any particular company and it's people across the country, people are more open to sharing. And I just really want to, it's not grow the foundation, but grow the impact that we have to really help people with their challenges. Because this is a difficult industry to work in. You know, CRM, we say it's a lifestyle, it's not a job. And sometimes that lifestyle is like, I mean, I'm a city girl. I never hiked or camped in my childhood or teen years. And that might sound really weird to say, because now I can go in the field like, you know, like anybody else, and I can quad and Argo and, you know, do all the things. But every now and again, I'm out there and I'm like, if my mom could see me now, you know? So.
Your mom just heard you use Argo as a verb. That's how,
Well, that's actually one of the most, one of the things I did with Instagram was like, here, download Instagram and follow us. You can see all the things that we do and you can understand our job. Yeah. So, yeah, I think we need to, I think that the industry needs a shift in, you know, how things are done and, you know, how can we make things better so that we have more archaeologists and we grow the next generation of great archaeologists. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fantastic mission and something that like we are more than happy to promote and anything that we can do to share sort of the principles of Fairfield and also get people in contact with it and promote it. So thank you so much for coming on, Margarita. It's been great talking to you. And we will talk again soon, I think.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I'm totally happy to come down to Lethbridge to speak to your classes. It would be so fun.
Yeah, we would love to have you.
And thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Margarita. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So Ken, we've just finished chatting with Margarita, and we've learned that this will in fact be the first episode of season 3, and that's because the Fairfield has an uptake for new mentees in September.
Yeah, and we want to make sure that information gets out to everybody, all the listenership, and gets shared on all the socials and everything to cast that net widely for all prospective mentees to the program. And actually, I suspect two mentors that would be interested in taking part in the program is kind of my sense as well.
I think that's right. And so it was a fun conversation, and we appreciate Margarita coming on to talk about that. I think we've both been kind of following Fairfield a bit. I mean, we follow them on social media, so we see their stuff, but also because it really is a sort of who's who of Canadian archaeology. And so those are all folks that we know, are familiar with their work, and are valuable colleagues. So we really, really appreciate that. So, Ken, I think we should cue in the listener a little bit on what's coming up this season. And the first thing that we should warn them about is that because we had this weird summer schedule, the opening of season 3 may be a little bit disjointed.
Yes.
because we'll be describing what we did for the rest of our summer.
Right.
But then we have a rough idea for a theme.
Yeah.
Which is that we're gonna emphasize human-environmental interaction.
That's right. So we'll be talking to people. We'll be talking about our own research and how that applies. And we'll be identifying some new great sites for our listeners to sink their teeth into. And I think probably we're sort of hoping to explore further horizons and probably another live show at some point, I think, is the idea. I think so.
I
think it'd be really fun to get together again, either in Fredericton or at some point we should do a live show in Lethbridge. We'll figure that out over the next few weeks, I think, and over the coming months.
Ken, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty excited to do a live show in a custom Circle CRM hoodie.
Oh yeah,
and a waterproof Eco4 backpack.
Exactly.
I think that's going to be just the ticket
and,
for us.
And hopefully, we have some attendees that are just throwing swag at us from the crowd, right? So like, I've got a different, I have a different themed our company hat to wear every day.
I should hope. I mean, I think the other thing that we are looking forward to talking a bit about is we're doing some research together for the we obviously have been on and off for the last point.
This is actually kind of the first real project that we've worked on together right from the get-go.
That's right. Yeah, I think that this is the first project maybe that we plan to work on.
Yes. Yeah.
So we may have more information about that, which will be fun. And I think the other thing is we've got some probably some live takes from conferences coming up.
Yep, live stuff from conferences and potentially a couple of big book launches this fall stuff that we're involved with and that colleagues of ours are involved with. And lots of exciting publications and things coming out over the next couple months, too.
That's right. And I think before we let the listener go here at the start of season 3, we just wanted to thank you for sticking around for season 3, Tokyo Drift, I believe.
We're calling it. Is it Electric Boogaloo is another one? Or is that a sequel?
That's a great question.
But remember too, listener, that we are on the mission to 10K. And so you too can strap in and join us as we shoot for the 10K moon. And I think we're hovering
And Ken, the good thing about that is even if we miss the 10K moon, we'll land among the stars.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where our numbers start. I think you need to, what's the biz word for stalling?
Oh, I need to stall?
Yeah. Well, no, there's a name for it, isn't there? In radio programming where you're kind of running with something.
Oh, we just want to avoid dead air. Is that what
you're saying? Where you're running with something while somebody's trying to do something in the background.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, one other thing we talk about is just that today, August 13th, if the listener wants, they could see us on the CBC in Fredericton.
Yeah, that's right.
We were on the CBC this evening. We were interviewed this afternoon, talking about the podcast, and so. We appreciate the CBC local folks for inviting us onto that. I think it's viewable on the website. Is that right, Ken? And if the, obviously you should watch the whole program, but if you don't want to watch the whole program, you can scroll to 9 minutes and 45 seconds.
Yes, and you'll see us.
And you'll see two of us. And what you'll be particularly struck by is two things, one of which is the look of terror in a CBC announcer's eyes when she has to pronounce my name. And then you'll also be impressed that she pronounced it exactly right, which I was shocked about.
Yep.
Usually that blinking for help is not usually followed by a correct pronunciation of my last name, but it was. And the other thing you'll notice is that Ken and I did not know what to do with our hands, and so
the camera shifting. The cameraman graciously, or the producer, whoever ended up doing the final cutting, graciously avoided too many shots of my hands. That was something that I'm glad they didn't show a whole lot of.
Yeah, no, I think we were we both looked a little nervous because we were. But thanks CBC for including us.
And thanks Ali for making that happen. That was really exciting. And to update the listener, we are currently sitting at 8558 listens on RSS, which means we're probably closing in on like probably 8800 or so on Apple Podcasts, which always seems to have a little bit more accurate stats than RSS.
We say accurate because it's got bigger stats. So
they're also proprietary, that, yeah. Which makes me think they're probably more accurate than.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah.
Anything that's secret and occulted must be better.
Exactly.
That's been actually the motto of our discussion of public archaeology, is that secret is better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But that's not true, listener. Don't listen to Gabe.
No. Yeah. That was a joke. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
So, Gabe.
Emmanuel, if you could put in a sound effect, maybe a laugh track. Just let them know that
yes.
Yeah.
Or the Great Auk, like it just make it. It's like,
yes.
So, Gabe, I guess we'll see you. Happy trails to New Hampshire.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week, and we're continuing to gather podcast tracks here over the next week or so while I'm bumping around New Brunswick, and listener, it is going to be a joy to talk to you here over the next few months as we launch season 3. And stay tuned for a trailer. Yeah, sure. We're gonna have a trailer coming out soon.
Yes, Ken. I wasn't gonna say that we're gonna have a trailer because now we're committed.
Well, I think that's a good thing though. That
I'm
committing us to doing this trailer.
It's a management strategy.
It is.
Good. Okay. Well. All right. So Ken, we've made several big commitments. One of which is that we're gonna try to get this out in August. Sorry, Emmanuel. And then the other one being that we're gonna produce a trailer, and I guess we're doing this.
And if it's mid-September and you're listening to this and you haven't seen a trailer yet, you know that our time management has not been on par.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Well, listener, it's been a joy to spend this evening with you. We've even actually said what day it is today so you could find the CBC interview. So you're going to, we have this weird, this is the first time I think we've ever had a temporal anchor.
Yep.
Yep. Or ball and chain.
If you're following the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we would be, we're the, what's the term they use?
Ken, this will shock you, but I don't follow the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I've lost it. You know what, listener?
I had an MCU replaced on my Subaru recently. It was very expensive.
I think it's the Anchor timeline or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, we didn't tell them what year it was.
No. We could be coming from the future.
We could. All right, listener. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for joining us for season 3. And we will be back with more season 3 content very soon. And we'll talk to you soon, Ken.
Talk to you soon, Gabe. Talk to you soon, listener. And keep those emails coming. We love that mail.
Have a good night, listener.